Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. Today we'll be speaking to Professor Hardev Panda, Professor of Medical Oncology at the University of Surrey. His translational research group focuses on the development of both biomarkers and drugs in order to improve cancer outcomes. Specifically, throughout his career, he has led on research investigating the use of live viruses, immunotherapy, and cancer vaccines for the treatment of cancer. And in this podcast, he'll be sharing with us his insights on oncolytic viral therapy. This links in with an excellent Science in Focus article he authored earlier this year on the same topic. Professor Hardev Panda, thanks very much for joining us and your excellent article about oncolytic viral therapy. I'd like to start off just by asking you a little bit about the rationale for this treatment and why it should be used.
So the oncolytic virus story goes back probably more than a century, and it started off with lots of case report and anecdotal reports of patients with very well-established cancers, so very well documented, even 100 years ago, and these patients incurring a viral infection, and as a result, their tumor being eradicated. So this is sort of built up from case reports through to a small series, through to some quite revolutionary clinical trials in the 1950s with all sorts of viruses that could be described as exotic, mainly in the United States, and unfortunately associated with some very dubious clinical practices in terms of patient information and consent, right through to the modern era where we're able to understand virus biology, engineer the viruses to try and get rid of some of the pathogenicity and focus on their cancer-killing properties. So although it's a slightly abstract sort of concept, it has been actually out in the medical literature as a sort of almost a medical curiosity for a while. And now we are in a position to understand the basic virus biology and perform these engineering tasks to make these agents safe and increase their targeting towards cancer specifically. This has become much more interesting and much more relevant. And of course, the end of the line was an oncolytic virus, T-VEC, herpes virus, for the treatment of malignant melanoma, which was licensed last year. So you can imagine that it's the endpoint of any therapeutic strategy, really, and that's been achieved.
So it's really been exciting news that T-VEC received FDA approval last year, as you say. But just going back to how this therapy works, so how does it actually kill the cancer?
Well, it depends on the virus. There are a number of reasons why oncolytic viruses kill cancer cells and spare normal cells. They may be due to entry of the virus specifically into cancer cells, so molecules on cancer cells that are overexpressed. So for example, the ICAM1 receptor, an adhesion molecule, commonly upregulated in a broad range of malignancies. And the Coxsackie A21 virus, for example, uses the ICAM1 receptor to get into the cells. And we and others have shown that this is really very selective. And if you don't have ICAM on your cells, then the virus just doesn't get in. The other two sort of reasons that are broadly thought to allow the selectivity is probably the main one is that the normal cells, when they get infected with a virus, they trigger various receptors which are intracellular, and this leads to the expression of interferon. So the so-called interferon response is a normal physiological response to a virus infection. And if you generate interferon, basically you'll eradicate the virus. You won't allow virus to propagate and to generate daughter products, virions, and therefore the virus infection effectively snubbed out. Now, the one thing we do know about cancer cells is that you lose the interferon signaling response. So you lose this natural protection against virus infections. So the virus is allowed to replicate. And if it replicates in the cells, the cell can harbor the replication. It can resist it for a while and then get to a certain point, a threshold, after which the virus just starts to multiply rapidly and therefore the cell can't sustain it and is destroyed. The third reason that oncolytic viruses are selective is based on cell signaling. We know that if cells, for example, with RAS mutations, which is very common in cancer, as you know, we know those cancer cells are more susceptible to certain viruses. And this is due to, again, a lack of a protective response, a sort of molecular switch, which normally switched on to try and snuff out the virus to damp down its replication potential. And if you're a RAS mutant, for example, you lose this response, so the virus remains switched on in terms of its replication. There's no counter signal to damp down its replication potential. So we have three potential processes. Either the virus gets in more selectively on the basis of de novo expression of certain molecules on the cell surface, or the other two reasons are a lack of an interferon response or some cell signaling defect, which is common in cancer, but of course we don't see that in normal cells.
And so in terms of killing the cancer cells itself, is it as simple as that then the virus replicates within the cancer cell or within the microenvironment and that disrupts the cancer? Or are there other ways that it also leads to killing of the cancer cell?
Yes, so that's a very good question. So, of course, there are a range of different oncolytic viruses, and the answer to your question is it depends on the virus. Some viruses kill purely by an apoptosis-type mechanism, which one would recognize in the context of cytotoxic drugs and radiation therapy. So they induce apoptosis in a fairly conventional way. They probably induce a subform of apoptosis, which also includes inflammation, so-called inflammatory apoptosis, which upregulates certain cytokine genes at the same time. There are other viruses, and the same virus can kill different cancers in different ways. So the other way of killing cancer cells is by starvation, so-called autophagy. So certain viruses induce autophagy and induce cell death in that way. And there are other ways of killing cancer cells, either through a necrosis-type pathway, so a necrotic process. And you would see on histology, for example, after the tumor is treated, it looks indistinguishable from necrosis due to any other insult. But we do know now is the way that cancer cells die is very complex, and we have crossovers between apoptosis and necrosis, so-called necroptosis, and all sorts of other complex mixture of mechanisms, really. So the answer to your question, we started off in this field thinking that all we had to do was get the virus into the cell, the virus would replicate, and then the cell would burst open. And that's the sort of cartoons we show at a number of talks. It's bit more complicated than that. The viruses are very good at inducing good old-fashioned apoptotic cell death. They're very efficient at that, but they have these other mechanisms. The other thing we do know is that some viruses are able to target tumor vasculature and destroy that, and that's very important, obviously, in terms of the tumor microenvironment.
And added to that, you mentioned in your article about these viruses activating the host's immune response.
Yes, and so this is the most exciting aspect of the oncolytic virus story, I think, is that by itself, although oncolytic viruses have a sort of unusual pharmacology in the sense that, unlike drugs entering a tumor and being broken down and activated, generally you'd expect the amount of drug in the environment to go down with time, whereas with viruses, in terms of traditional cytotoxic, the big difference with viruses, of course, is you get amplification within the tumor because it's a living agent. And so its pharmacodynamic, pharmacokinetic properties are characteristics are very, very different to traditional cytotoxics. What we've known for a long time, was that we don't necessarily need to infect every single cell. We sort of assumed early on that this was due to amplification within the tumor and that eventually you'd get enough replication that you'd probably destroy a critical mass of cells and therefore the tumor would be eliminated, or certainly functionally. What we know now is that actually from the T-VEC story is that the value of the oncolytic viruses is almost certainly due to their immunogenicity. So they are capable of inducing a very broad immune response. And this is important because it's not just a response you see with peptide vaccines or with DNA vaccines where it's, you know, slightly singular or linear. What the viruses are capable of is inducing both innate and adaptive immune responses. So in other words, you can induce things like NK cells, which are potent anti-cancer agents. And also by destroying the tumor, you're releasing all sorts of antigens and priming immunity through this debris being taken up by antigen-presenting cells, moving to lymph nodes, and then priming CD4 and CD8 cells. So in a way, you've got the best of all worlds, and we know that most immunotherapies at work are the ones that are broad. I think the very focused single-antigen type approaches have been limited over the years, and I think the oncolytic viruses provide a potentially very broad platform for success, and I think this is seen in the T-VEC study, in the original JCO paper, where the investigators were regularly seeing visceral metastases regressing after cutaneous injection of metastases, which is what we'd hope to see from all the vaccine strategies all of us interested in this field have been involved in for the last 20 years. So in fact, T-Vex, the first time that's been ever been shown convincingly, to be honest.
And you've touched on some of these already, but what are the advantages of using oncolytic viral therapies? Why should we be investing in research in this rather than conventional cytotoxic drugs?
That's a good question. So I think there are some logistics in terms of having a biological agent, live virus, in the pharmacy. Of course, we already have live BCG for bladder cancer, so we've already been there. The biosafety level is similar between viruses and BCG. So in terms of having these agents in the NHS shouldn't be a problem. Their key advantage, I think, is so far is very, very little toxicity. We've seen effects in terms of immune induction and anti-tumor effects, but this has not been at the expense of significant toxicities in patients across several thousand patients, probably worldwide, with 8 to 10 oncolytic viruses. The lack of effect on quality of life then, of course, allows us to combine these, because ultimately that's probably where they're going to go, with agents such as checkpoint inhibitors, which are associated with toxicity. So, you know, whereas we're looking at combining two different types of checkpoint inhibitors and having, you know, fairly potentially severe toxicities as a result, we are able to partner the oncolytic viruses quite effectively with other agents without adding to the burden for the patient. I think in terms of the choice of viruses, and of course we're now starting to get into arming these viruses with different molecules, we're opening the door into a next generation of viral therapies where we can try and modulate the immune response towards particular cancers. You know, we may, for example, in pancreatic cancer, we don't really want to express GM-CSF because it's potentially a pro-cancer growth factor. Whereas in melanoma treatment, the GM-CSF, the virus, really is helping the priming of the immune response after tumor destruction. So these sort of lessons we're learning, and of course, some very clever engineering means that we can use viruses to get into the tumor microenvironment, and then after a bit of a delay, then express immunomodulatory cytokines a little bit later. And timing of that sort of sequential treatment also can be realized with these sort of agents, which you couldn't really do with radiation and cytotoxic treatment.
One might anticipate there may be an inherent fear amongst clinicians or patients that they're having delivered to them a virus that may potentially be pathogenic itself. Is that something you've encountered, and has that been overcome in any way?
Actually, in all the trials I've ever done, I've never had that conversation with a single patient who I've talked to about participating in a clinical trial. Obviously, this is part of the consent process, is to review and discuss all potential effects of any of these viruses. But actually, quite the contrary. I've had significant interest from virtually every patient and family I've met looking on an alternative way of treating cancer, and they see this in the vast, vast majority is very exciting, innovative, and perhaps mistakenly slightly holistic sort of feel to this, that this is how what nature intended. Because some of the viruses are as they appear in nature. They are wild type. They're not genetically modified. So I've never really had that conversation with any patient, certainly I've been involved in clinical trials. Nobody's ever turned down participation in a virus study that I've run due to the fear of any sort of short, medium, or long-term toxicity or some sort of negative effects of the virus, both to themselves or to their sort of close relatives. I think it's one of those situations where a very measured, coherent discussion plus very good patient information documentation is needed. That's just common sense approach, really.
That's really interesting to hear. And in terms of the scope for this type of therapy, what kind of cancers do you envisage them being used on?
Well, I think the big stumbling block for a range of therapies, including viral therapy, is the tumor microenvironment. And I think that if you have a very dense and very large tumor, then nothing's going to get in the center of it. Clearly isn't, because the physical trafficking of even viruses to the center of very large, dense tumors, where cancers like pancreatic cancer with a desmoplastic stromal reaction that's incredibly dense tissue, it's just not going to happen. And so, you know, one has to be quite logical about this. So, for example, small tumor volume, micrometastatic disease, small volume disease, clearly these would be very amenable. And I guess that the type of malignancy, liquid malignancies, lymphoma, these are sort of areas oncolytic viruses haven't really gone very far at the moment. We've concentrated mainly on epithelial tumours and tumours where there is documented sort of immune responses, such as melanoma, for example. The other things that influence this, of course, is access. So there are opportunities, of course, with things like melanoma for direct tumour injection. And we are going to see a few studies which are sort of going from phase one to sort of towards phase two of ultrasound-guided or CT-guided tumour injections of lymph nodes and tumour masses with big doses of viruses just to overcome some of the tumour microenvironment issues. So rather than rely on intravenous delivery, the virus circulates around the bloodstream, finds its way to metastases and then does its work, we might need to give it some help and have a program of actually direct into tumour injections, but inside the body rather than on the skin surface. So those may be tumours that are larger and where the microenvironment issues may be more limiting. But on the flip side, of course, if you've got patients with relatively small volume disease, perhaps at early stage of relapse after first-line treatment, that might be ideal, both in terms of the tumour volume you're trying to treat and also the fact that it gives patients their conventional options afterwards. And we know that the immune system, again, it's not particularly well-defined when the immune system becomes, in inverted commas, suppressed, but we know that advanced disease reduces immunogenicity and anti-tumour responses generally. It is, as we get bigger tumours, more advanced tumours, these are more, of course, immune tolerance. So it's probably in our best interest to use these agents a little bit earlier. And finally, of course, is a combination with exciting molecules like checkpoint inhibitors, where they're uniquely placed, really, in a way, much more probably even than peptides and polypeptide vaccines, using oncolytic viruses with checkpoint inhibitors, as evidenced by the combination of T-VEC with ipilimumab in the recent edition of JCO, showed actually quite remarkable effects.
And you've already mentioned a bit about the Optim study when T-VEC was used in malignant melanoma. So what kind of responses were seen? How effective was the therapy?
It was a slightly different endpoints than that are conventionally regarded. So it were, the endpoint really was the idea of disease control rate, DCR, as opposed to traditional RECIST type of criteria. But I guess in terms of in Optimum, it was quite a large study, but I think it seemed to benefit quite a significant number of patients in the sense of disease control, both by lack of progression and, as I said, the most interesting and most compelling sort of thing for me was the effect on metastases that were distant, particularly in the viscera. So I guess that the issue with the Optimum study was that it was an intratumoral therapy, and the aim of the study was a total disease control rate. And the problem was that because the tumours which had been injected were not then removed and then examined histologically, one was only looking at the size of the tumours afterwards. So in terms of the actual response, both by direct physical measurement or any other method, was obviously slightly flawed in the sense that there may have been something on the skin, but it may be non-viable tissue. So what really they should have done, I guess, in a way, is pathological response. So although the overall response rate may look relatively modest at 25 or 30% or 25% or so, that you have to take into account that no biopsies were done. So this wasn't pathological response. This is just in terms of size. It didn't quite reach the median overall survival as a group. And is something like 23 months versus 18, 19 months. But in a subgroup of patients, it clearly did have a statistical difference. So slightly earlier stage in the stage 3 patients. So it's a difficult one in the sense that it was not a direct study one can directly compare to traditional cytotoxic or radiation studies, because the endpoints were slightly different. But I think the most impressive thing about it was that there was a subgroup where there was an overall survival, of course. It's a intratumoral injection therapy, which, again, no large-scale study like this has been done before. And to me, the main thing was the effect on visceral metastases, shrinkage of tumours in the liver and lung in a significant proportion of patients.
Professor Hardev Panda, thank you very much for talking us through a really exciting and really innovative new approach to treating cancers. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening, and look out for our next podcast that's coming out in January and examines the lack of provision of radiotherapy in low and middle income countries and what can be done to improve that. It will feature some highly insightful and inspiring interviews, so it's going to be well worth a listen.